This is the current federal tax developments for the week of March the 20th, 2017. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CPE, a division of the Lascalzo Institute. This week's session, we're going to discover mailing may be tougher than you think. The developments this week we're going to look at will include the IRS giving a short additional period of time for extensions for those affected by Winter Storm Stella. We'll find students in a State Department-sponsored program were not allowed to deduct their travel expenses. The IRS, in a private letter ruling, applies the unit of property rules to an auto racing operation. And a taxpayer discovers, in what we'll call our title session, why it's not recommended to use a postage meter when mailing a critical tax-related document. Well, this week wasn't a whole lot going on again, but part of the reason this week was because Winter Storm Stella effectively shut down much of the East Coast for a good chunk of the week. So in fact, we had very few developments this week until Thursday when the tax court finally published some cases. But one of the fallouts of that was that we had the first major due date fall during the period of time when people were still digging out from Stella. So starting to let you know, IRS News Release IR 2017-61. Now, this podcast, of course, is officially published on Monday. We usually post it on the Saturday before. So if you're listening early on, you still have some time to take advantage of this. If you're listening after Monday, well, this is a historical note for you. But the IRS granted businesses that were affected by Winter Storm Stella, who were unable to file their return or their extension timely by March 15th, to file for an extension on or before March 20th. Now, interestingly enough, the IRS news release here, which is 2017-61, doesn't actually say that you could file the return late, which is kind of interesting. You have to file the extension, and certainly I would follow the rule, follow what they say. So I would certainly file the 7004 by Monday and then file the return shortly thereafter. But if you are affected by this, again, you have until Monday. So if you're listening on Tuesday, tough luck. But if you have until Monday for a business to file an extension that was unable to file their extension due to Winter Storm Stella, if you are doing this, if you're filing on paper, you should write Winter Storm Stella on your Form 7004 extension relief. Interestingly enough, the service suggests that you file your form electronically. And of course, if you do that, you're not going to be able to write Winter Storm Stella on anything. So presumably, the IRS is simply going to allow a 7004 to run through Monday and presumptively decide it's Winter Storm Stella issues. We'll have to see how all that runs. But nevertheless, if you were impacted by that, something did not get filed by March 15th, and that relates in some way, shape, or form to Winter Storm Stella, you can go ahead and file those extensions by Monday. So, you know, get moving, shall we say, if we're not yet past the deadline. First, we'll start out this week on the cases with a case that is a case of Liljeburg versus Commissioner. That's a case of 148 Tax Court Number 6. This was issued on, like a lot of things this week, the 16th, which was Thursday when the tax court released the case. It is a published decision because, in fact, the IRS, or I should say the tax court, had never directly ruled on this issue. And this is a unique question about whether students who are non-U.S. citizens who came over to the U.S. for summer work programs sponsored by the State Department were able to deduct the travel costs of coming to and from the United States. This is going to be governed, and now, by the way, in all of these cases, the treaties between the countries in question, the United States, did not have an impact on the case. So that was something which was important to understand in all the cases. There were actually three of these students whose cases came up together. By the way, the amount of tax being challenged was very small, so obviously these came up as test cases for the much larger group to decide whether or not a deduction would be allowed. The program in question is the Summer Work Travel Program, which is part of the State Department's Exchange Visitor Program. And the purpose of that program is, according to the court case, to provide foreign college university students with opportunities to interact with U.S. citizens, experience U.S. culture while sharing their own culture with Americans they meet, travel to the United States, and work in jobs that require minimum training and are seasonal and temporary in order to earn funds to help defray a portion of their expenses. And so we have seasonal employment, summer jobs, right? So these students come over during an extended break, what we used to call summer break. These days, of course, extended breaks may come anywhere, but between the academic years. And they come over here for up to 4 months, and they live in the U.S. They have a job here in the U.S., and you know, they interact with U.S. citizens, and then they have to go back. The rules of the program do require that they can only be here for 4 months at a maximum. They're here on a visa that requires that they, you know, that basically they have to return to their home country. They have no intention of staying here. We do not plan to abandon our residence in the foreign country and meet certain other criteria. So on a J visa. Now, the lead taxpayer in this case was a citizen resident of Finland. And we also learned about the other two, but nevertheless, we'll talk about this gentleman because he's the one that the court spent most of its time on. He entered the United States on May 21st of 2012, departs in September. During his time in the U.S., he worked as a lifeguard in Wisconsin. He earned $4,403 in wages. Basically, he traveled around the country, and he has never returned to the United States since leaving in September 15th of 2012. He filed a Form 1040-NR. And on the return, he deducted various items on the return. But the key issue for today is we're going to talk about essentially the $995 for the airfare that he paid and that he claimed as a deduction on his Form 1040-NR. Generally, to claim travel related to a trade or business, you have to meet the criteria found in Section 162A2. And that allows deduction for travel expenses, including amounts for meals and lodging other than amounts that are lavish, while away from home in pursuit of a business. Now, the law has required generally to meet that requirement, the taxpayer has to show three things. The court cited the case of Barone versus Commissioner, which is a 1985 tax court case that was affirmed on appeal by the Ninth Circuit. So the three criteria is the travel's got to be ordinary and necessary. The travel must be incurred while away from a taxpayer's tax home. That is normally the taxpayer's principal place of employment, not necessarily where the taxpayer's personal residence is. And the travel must have been incurred in pursuit of a trade or business. Now, the IRS agreed with the taxpayers, you know, taxpayer and IRS agree that the first criteria, the travel was ordinary and necessary, and the last criteria is pursued as part of their trade or business. He had to get to Wisconsin to do lifeguarding work in Wisconsin, that both of those were satisfied. But the fight came on the second one. You know, was this in fact traveling away from your tax home? There is a special rule, you know, now in a simple case, let's talk about a case like for my own self. If I'm going to let's say I'm going to travel from my office in Phoenix to, let's say, do a course in Portland, Oregon. Well, the travel from Phoenix to Portland and the travel, you know, and back is considered to be deductible travel. That's because my tax home is here in Phoenix, where my office is, and I'm going to a remote location. Now, things are a little different. Let's say instead of going up to Portland to teach for 1 day or a couple of days, I was going up there and taking an assignment to, let's say, run a training program for a group in the Oregon area. And I was going to stay up there for 9 months. In that case, a special rule comes in play. If I'm away from home on a temporary basis, now, according to Section 162, this has got to be less than 1 year. And, you know, and it cannot be indefinite. But I took that 9-month assignment in Portland. I can take travel expenses related to that. The temporary assignment rule is going to be effectively, to a certain extent, what we're trying to make work in this case. Now, the IRS said, well, there's something fundamentally different in this case because these people don't have a trade or business in, you know, their home country, in this case in Finland, that they were traveling from. They're students. They are, you know, they're not pursuing a trade or business there. They don't have a tax home there at this point. And when they return back to Finland, you know, they're not going to there's not going to be a continuing trade or business they're going to pick up. The court points out that the whole point of this temporary travel rule was to allow us to defer the cost of having to maintain two residences. If I take that 9-month assignment in Portland, I'm not going to abandon my house in Phoenix. You know, I'm not going to say, oh, tough luck, I'm giving up my home in Phoenix, you know, getting rid of everything, you know, moving everything up to Portland. No, I'm going to go ahead and maintain a residence here in Phoenix, but because I am going to be 9 months in the Portland area, I will also be maintaining a place to live in Portland. So the concept is this deduction allows a deduction because the business requirements force me to have duplicate living expenses. Because I need to maintain my house in Phoenix because that's where my business is I came from, or I'm going back to. Now, the students obviously didn't have that. So the question was, how are they going to beat this? Well, they said their case was similar to the situation of a judge in the case of United States versus LeBlanc, which was a Fifth Circuit case. There, you know, in the LeBlanc case, we had a justice of the Louisiana Supreme Court being appointed there, and he had to go basically work in New Orleans, which is where the court was. But under the rules of the state, he represented a district and he had to maintain his home in that district. So he needed to maintain a home away from Louisiana, from New Orleans. And as you probably are aware, New Orleans is down the southern edge of Louisiana. If your district had to be in the northern portion of Louisiana, that's not a real short trip. So he had to maintain two residences. The court in that case, the Fifth Circuit on appeal, allowed him to claim that double deduction. However, the court didn't find that this was really equivalent to that. The students claimed, well, it's equivalent because, see, we had to say we weren't going to be leaving. I wasn't going to be leaving Finland. I had no intention of leaving Finland. My residence was in Finland. So I had to maintain a residence in Finland and a residence in the U.S. Therefore, that's the sort of double expense that, you know, that you're essentially giving me a break for, and it was imposed by the business requirements because to be a lifeguard in Wisconsin under this program, I had to have a J visa, and the J visa required me to maintain residence in Finland. The court said, no, you had to maintain being a resident of Finland. You had to intend to go back to Finland, but there was no business requirement to keep a home in Finland during that time frame. You know, essentially, that wasn't the requirement. And because of that, there was no secondary home, and you weren't like the judge in the LeBlanc case. Therefore, we're going to have to treat you as having a non-deductible. This is just a real long commuting expense to your life, to your essentially lifeguard job in Wisconsin. So tough luck. Tax court says under that program, you're not going to get your travel expenses. Next up, we have the case, we have PLR 2017-10006. This was issued on the 10th. And this is the case with an interesting problem where the IRS was asked by a auto racing team to tell them what their unit of property was. Now, you might think, you know, you look at an auto racing team, they have a car, it goes on the track, right? Car goes round the track. You would think the car is unit of property. You'd think that, but the racing team said, the problem is it's not quite that simple. In the high-end auto racing teams, you know, we're talking about the top levels in auto racing, those cars are highly specialized. And in fact, what they really are, as they point out in this ruling, is an assemblage of parts. They assemble a particular set of parts into a car, you know, to make up an entire car for a particular race. Immediately after the race, they totally disassemble that car. Take the parts all apart, right? When they go to a new track, they may need totally different parts because of the nature of the track, the nature of the race. They'll have to get rid of some parts because some have simply been worn out due to the very rough treatment of racing. Some may have been destroyed in an accident in the prior race. So they assemble up a brand new set of parts and put a car on the track. So while that car may look like the car that raced the week before, in reality, it could be radically different than what was raced the week before. The taxpayer said, you know, we want to know what is our unit of property for disposition purposes. Do we have to dispose of an entire car? And if we do, how do we determine when we dispose of an entire car? Or will the parts be treated as the unit of property, which is obviously what they wanted? Well, the IRS in this case said that because of the unique situation in this case, the IRS agreed that the parts themselves were what we were looking at here. So we're looking at the individual parts that are disassembled and come back into being a car. Those are the things we're going to track. We're going to look for them for dispositions, and we're going to look for them for purposes of other tracking under the depreciation rules, under the capitalization rules. We're not going to look for the car as a whole, because despite the fact that for you and I, you know, in my business, my car is a single unit of property, which it is, you know, a Toyota Camry I've got, that's one unit of property. But for these, for a racing team, that is clearly not the case. And the IRS said they're allowed to treat as a unit of property the individual parts of the car, and computes, you know, recognized losses when they dispose of or scrap the parts from the car by tracking those individual pieces. Interesting case. Obviously, if you've got a high-end auto racing organization, that's probably important. But conceivably, the concept could apply outside of that. So if you have a unique fact pattern, you might want to discuss the options of, you know, are we really close enough to this that maybe the obvious unit of property isn't really the obvious unit of property? Next up, let's talk about the case of Grimm versus Commissioner to close out. And this is our poor mailing case in this case. Grimm versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2017-44. The problem we have in this case is, how do you prove timely filing of a document? The document in this case was a tax court petition, but the same basic rules apply to tax returns, extensions, and all the other sort of things we do. Now, under Internal Revenue Code Section 7502, that's the section that a lot of you are going to refer to as a timely mailing equals timely filing rule. That rule, it doesn't really say just putting it in the mailbox on the date the return is due, it counts as filing the return. Rather, it says if that document reaches the IRS or tax court after the last day for filing. Obviously, if I mail the return on April 15th, it's not going to get to the IRS by April 15th, or I suppose I should say this year, April 18th, mailed on the 18th. It's not going to make it from Phoenix to the DC to basically to Fresno, which is where we'd have to file paper returns, and into the IRS's hands by the end of the day, no matter how early in the day I mail it on the last day for filing. But if that envelope is postmarked by a U.S. Postal Service employee, and that postmark date is legible and reads effectively, the, you know, as of no later than the last day for filing, then the return is timely filed. The rule goes on to state that if a postmark's not applied by the Postal Service, the IRS was allowed to write regulations to define how that would work. In this case, we're looking at a postage meter. You know, the good old traditional postage meter type thing, Pitney Bowes, stamps.com, that sort of structure where you print the postage in your office and you apply it. You do either one of those, you'll notice it puts a date on the quote stamp or stamp equivalent that it's putting on the envelope. Well, the question becomes, does that date control? Well, it will control if the following two things are true. It automatically controls. It'll still be considered valid. The postmark is legible, and it's on or before the last date for filing, and the document is received by the date such mail would normally have been received if been postmarked by the Postal Service on the date in question. Now, okay, that's kind of okay, guess better than nothing, but obviously what happens if the item gets delayed in the mail and it doesn't arrive within that normal time frame? For most of us in the country, the normal time frame would be 2 or 3 days. If I mail it from Phoenix, even if I'm going to the tax court in DC, we would expect within 4 to 5 days that that letter should be in DC. You know, on the outside, maybe 10 days they might allow. But let's say instead it arrives a month later. Now, have we seen that happen in the mail? Yes, we've definitely seen that happen in the mail. In my case, my firm is actually still, we have no idea, neither does the client, what happened to a $17,000 check that was mailed to us a couple of years ago. It's still bouncing around somewhere. It's never popped up anywhere and certainly never made it to us. But sometimes, out of the blue, those things pop up. So if that check were to appear today, which is not totally inconceivable, then it would be well later, even though it may have been mailed long before. Well, if that happens, here's what a taxpayer has to do. And to be honest, it's a very difficult way to prove that was still timely filed. First thing may be relatively easy. You have to show the document was actually deposited in the U.S. mail before the last collection from the place of deposit on the last day for filing. So I need to show that I have this metered mail envelope, that I dropped it in a postal receptacle, and that it was before the last pickup time on that day. So, okay, I videotape myself and, you know, whatever, videotape myself dropping it off, show the timestamp on there. I've now done it. I guess videotape's a bad term anymore. Most of us don't have videotape recorders. We just do things on our phone. But hey, I do that. So I prove that I mailed it timely, and I also got a picture of the pickup time, so I prove it was there before the pickup time. Well, that's great, but that's not enough. You have to prove the delay in receipt by the IRS, tax court, whoever, was due to a delay in transmission of the mail. And, okay, this is where it gets really tough. You got to show what the cause of the delay was. The odds of the taxpayer being able to do that, very low. In this case, the indictment was a tax court petition. It was received 24 days after the date showed on the postage meter. He mailed the petition from New Carlisle, Ohio, and was mailed to D.C. The court notes that normally 3 or 4 days is the maximum time we would expect it to take for an envelope to make it from New Carlisle, Ohio to Washington, D.C. The taxpayer did describe his mailing. Now, he used the postage meter because he does lots of mailing, and that's how he mails things out of his office. So he did this, and he actually postmarked it what essentially would be, you know, a couple of days early. So as the court noted, even if the petition had stayed in his office for a week after the postage meter date, he still would have done it timely. So he metered it. You know, he testified he metered it on this day. He testified that he puts it out for mailing. And maybe some days, you know, it would be placed in the mail immediately, and then they essentially, you know, take it out. So the court was okay saying, okay, we're kind of okay that you actually put this in the mail. You know, it was given to the Postal Service timely. Let's accept that. But here's the problem. All the taxpayer could do to satisfy the last two prongs was to express a general view of the service provided by the Postal Service has declined over the years. But he had no evidence of why this particular envelope had been delayed in getting to the tax court. Unfortunately, the way the regulation works, unless you can make that showing, you do not have timely filing. If you mail a tax document using a metering system, you are effectively taking the risk of not, if it's not delivered, or if it's delayed in some manner in the Postal Service, you've got a very real risk of having a late filed document and whatever consequences there may be from that late filing. I know clients consider it a pain, but you really have to tell them that certified mail down at the post office with the stamp from the postal employee is the best way to do it. Or you can use the private delivery services, but then you've got to check the approved list and you've got to get the document from their computer system before they delete it, which is all a bunch of steps the client will probably neglect to do. So the simplest way I've always told clients is, I know you hate going to the post office because nobody likes standing in line down there. But if this document is really important, you don't want the risk of it being said you didn't mail it timely, you really need that certified mail receipt from the Postal Service. That's going to be by far the most effective and least able to be fouled up way of proving timely mailing. Hey, it's spring right now. Didn't notice that, right? We're all got our heads down. You might have not looked up. And those of you who were in Winter Storm Stella last week might really wonder about this being spring. Those of us out here in Phoenix, the high today is going to be 95. So we're kind of aware. Now, by the way, for Phoenix, that is spring. Some of you may think that's summer. No. We're going way past that. So that's really spring here. So we're here at 95. Remember, spring also means we're going to be coming up shortly with, you know, sometime right after the 15th of April for most of us, you're going to be the time to start checking your state society catalogs to see what's happened and what's offered this year in continuing education. Remember, Congress continues to work on the American Healthcare Act, which may or may not pass, but certainly it continues to move this week, by the way, just updating you. It did clear the budget committee. As the time I record this, it is scheduled to go to a vote on Thursday of this coming week. So we'll see what happens there at the House level. And if it did, if it does pass the House there, then it would go on to the U.S. Senate. We've also been told there are already talk about modifications that have been agreed to be made to the bill. So keep your eye on that. But that's certainly something once tax season is over, you're going to be looking for courses to help you understand what Congress does, assuming they actually do these things coming forward. So take a look in your State Society catalogs. Take a look for your emails from the State Society as we get breaking news and updates and potentially look at things like webinars and the like to get added. And make sure as you're looking there, to don't forget, take a look at the courses that we'll be offering to you, both from LaScalzo and Associates for those in the A&A side, and with Nichols Patrick for those of you who have some tax issues to take a look at. So we'll be looking forward to seeing you in the live courses once tax season ends. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of March 20th, 2017. You can catch our daily updates at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. We post there as things happen so you can read them. You also can download a PDF with this week's information. By the way, at the very back of the PDF, I have put the news release from the IRS regarding the extended due date period. So if it's not the end of Monday yet, you want to get the details on that, go ahead and get that. It'll be at the back of the PDF. You can download from the weekly update section of the site. We also, if you want to follow me on Twitter, I post there. Whenever I post on the site, I will post there so you can follow me. My Twitter handle is at Ed Zollers. If you have any questions or comments, you can send those to edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. So now that we're past the first due date and we're heading toward the big due date, tax season gets interesting from this point out. So take care. Don't work too long. And we'll hopefully see you next week on Current Federal Tax Developments.